I'm Jason Louvre, and this is the Ultraculture Podcast. In this episode, I'm talking to Colly Fisher, one of my oldest friends and a compatriot in the exploration not just of magic, but in every area of consciousness expansion. Colly and I met back in 2000 or so on the Barbalith message board, a community of counterculture and occult thinkers that had sprung up around Grant Morrison's Invisibles comic book. We became close friends in real life when I moved to New York in 2003. Colly ran an access point of the Temple of Psychic Youth in Toronto in the 1980s, at which time she was deeply involved in investigating Wilhelm Reich's work with orgone energy. Colly has been involved in the occult world for a lot longer than me, and has been very closely associated with many of the key cultural flashpoints since the 1980s, so she was able to offer me a lot of guidance when I was first starting out. We used to have epic hours-long conversations about magic and conspiracy theories, where we try to dig into all the secret goings-on in the world and uncover what was really going on. Those are always incredibly fun and often goofy conversations to have. But I really wanted to capture one of those great magical talks for this podcast, and luckily that's exactly what I've been able to do. Our conversation here ranges from magic to Wilhelm Reich to dark matter to the Necronomicon to sexual liberation to everything in between. It was incredibly fun to tape, and I think you'll really, really enjoy it. Now, I should take this time to mention that I've just released a new, free, 10-day email training in chaos magic. When you sign up for it, you get an incredible range of goodies that I've been spending the last few months getting ready for you. From a free book on sigils, to video training and meditation, to articles on occult theory and guided meditations, and a lot more. If you dig this podcast, please take a look at the course by going to ultraculture.org and grabbing the course there. Okay, here's the show. All right, I'm sitting here with my friend Colly Fisher in the back of my car in the parking lot underneath the LA Public Library, which has turned out to be the best place to record a podcast. Colly is in town in Los Angeles, and we're catching up, and we've been having a conversation about, what have we been talking about? Magic, dark matter, psychedelics.
Psychedelics. Is there something else in there? I think that was mostly it.
The media.
Yeah, well, you know, media, politics.
And one of the most interesting things we were talking about is the spikes of dark matter that have been discovered all around the planet, which was completely tripping me out.
Yeah, I saw this, I mean, you know, as you mentioned, taking scientific discoveries with a grain of salt is always a good thing to do because they change all the time. But I think that is sort of the point of science, is that it evolves and it's not a static. It's like, this is not how it is. We just think this is how it is right now.
But what was the thing with the dark matter? It was like you said they had discovered spikes of...
Yeah, apparently recently they... I don't know how they measure or determine these things. It's some kind of interference pattern between various other particles and how those particles flow into the electromagnetic field around the Earth, but that there are these like almost spermatozoid shaped spikes that like face out from the Earth as if we were a pincushion and the fat end is pointed towards the Earth, and then there's like these trail off spiky things surrounding the Earth, but like hundreds of them.
So this is totally bizarre. If there actually are spikes of, and I guess there actually are, as they've shown, spikes of dark matter all around the Earth, the first thing that I thought about was, how do the places on the ground correlate, like the places where the dark matter spikes are coming out of?
Right.
Like what are the, you know, is that like, are those particularly gnarly places to visit, or what's happening there?
I don't know. The appearance was more like it was a geometric quality. Not like it was ozone holes over specific locations, but more that, you know, for people that are interested in that kind of thing, like looking for correlations on the Great Sphere or like ley lines where there are points of ley line crossing and where are those dark matter spikes above in that way. But it's like a very sort of, you know, geometric based solely upon the electromagnetic field of the Earth. Though they were evenly distributed, which is funny because that means it wouldn't be the electromagnetic.
Okay.
It would be electrical or something more even and distributed than that.
Huh.
There weren't more over the North Pole or South Pole from the picture that I remember seeing online.
Wow. So one of the one of our common interests is Wilhelm Reich and orgone energy, and one of the most interesting things, you know, fascinating things to me about your work is the, you know, the in-depth work with Reich stuff and the understanding of kind of what would you call them, subtle energies, or, and not even in a New Age way, but the idea of life energy or subtle currents to reality.
It is. I have to say, it's like, I do consider, I think everyone should read Wilhelm Reich. I and this is like, puts me in a total kook zone if you wiki him, but I really think that he was maybe the greatest natural scientist of the 20th century. That the way he approached looking at relationships between life, function, form, and some simple concepts that I've used for like instructing kids is just genius. It's just because it's not chemical. It was based a lot on form and just looking at how things are in nature and trying to devolve principles from that.
So Reich was a student of Freud who, and fill in what I'm leaving out here, but he was a student of Freud who went from the psychoanalytic theory into looking at the basic biological functions of life and understanding how life energy is the expression of life energy in a healthy way is the key to healthy psychology, and that blocked life energy is kind of the underlying source of neuroses.
Neuroses, bad health. You know, his theory was that most cancers come from this place of blocked energy. But I mean, there is a step into that, you know, he worked with Freud, and Freud, in his research, if you look into it, discovered that a number of sexually repressed women, because it was not like the whole idea of trying to give a woman orgasm was not even really much of a concept back at that time. That was irrelevant. And even for men now too, there's having an orgasm and then there's coming.
Right.
And there's qualities between them. Like when you have a really, really serious good orgasm, it's a whole body experience. You feel your personal energy. I don't think anybody would deny this. And it's like, well, is that, you know, is that real or is it just an illusion in our minds? And I think the whole thing was that Reich and Freud back then discovered that this lack of sexual expression was causing a buildup of energy. Freud had to back off from these ideas because it sort of was improper and got into this whole sexual realm. And Reich was like, well, this is ridiculous. Why are we backing off? He was not really concerned about being politically correct ever. And he was just like, so let's investigate this. And he was the first person to measure with electrical devices the bioelectric charge of people, especially during the sexual act and during sexual excitation. And, you know, it was a major step because then all of a sudden, this is a quantifiable, this is a measurable thing. This is not some subtle energy in the way that it's like, could be a hallucination. This is sort of like taking a ruler and measuring something, you know? It makes it very concrete and measurable. And I think that's where he started with the sexual excitation energy. And for a number of years, he investigated that. And then he started to be curious about its place in the larger world, in the rest of the natural world, not just human beings, in how solar system forms. I mean, he applied it to all kinds of conditions and situations. And it's like, where is this energy? What is this energy? Where is it coming from? Is it purely chemical? Why is it flow this way? How does it get blocked? And, you know, it took him into slightly crazy places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and certainly not particularly socially approved places, in that he was thrown out of, if I'm getting this right, he was thrown out of first Austria, and then he was persecuted by the communists, and then eventually he was thrown out of the Psychoanalytic Society, and then persecuted by the communists, and then came to the United States, where he was accused of being a communist, and eventually put in prison for transporting his orgone devices across, or one of his students transported his orgone devices across state lines, and then he was thrown in the penitentiary in New York, where he very sadly died, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was one of those sort of bureaucratic things. It was a transporting medical equipment across state lines violation, which you'd think would just be, it's like, oh, please, can we just like write a fine or tell me I shouldn't do that again, right, or something? But I mean, he
really scared the, and it's such a, it's one of the biggest cases of public witch burning in the 20th century. It's something like from the Middle Ages. The FDA really came down on him and destroyed all of his devices and burned his books. And that's shocking, even for the, you know, even for the 1950s, but the 1950s were not that long ago. I've always been curious about what was it that about Reich's work that so threatened the FDA. I mean, certainly, you know, he was claiming to cure cancer, and from the FDA's perspective, I'm sure that was a dangerous, you know, case of medical quackery, or how they saw it. But they really came down on him with like Gestapo type techniques.
Well, I think people are afraid of, especially people who are repressed or conservative, as we were talking earlier, people have their worldviews. And if you try and deny their worldview or shake their worldview or change their worldview, people get very, very upset about it. You know, and it's like even liberal people who believe in, you know, this kind of subtle energy or that kind of subtle energy, or we were talking about, you know, sort of ayahuasca devotees.
Right.
And it's if you said, yeah, well, I'm not sure if that's for me, they'll be like, no, this is the best stuff. You have to do this. You have to do this. Like, why do I have to do anything? It's like, what are you telling me? Like, I have to eat chocolate? You know, like, what's the difference? It's like all these things. I mean, for me, it's just diversity. And therefore, just like, let people believe whatever they believe. These are aesthetic. To me, these are all aesthetic choices in a way that people make. It's like, what? How do I want to see the world? How do I want dressed? What colors do I want around me? What ideas do I want around me? What are the qualities of those ideas I have around me? And, you know, they're not all for me. They're not all for you. They're not all for anybody. But you got to keep them around, because it's just evolutionarily, the more diversity you have, the better you're prepared to take the next step. Because some stuff will always get thrown away. But if yes, you only have monoculture, then when you need to throw that away, you have nothing left.
Right. And I certainly think that Reich's work is definitely part of, you know, our potential evolution. But it's been interesting to me to think about, you know, since, you know, Reich wanted, in fact, Reich coined the phrase sexual revolution. But since his death, that's something we've seen happen in the West with, if you think about even starting with Elvis or the 60s and the idea of getting more free-flowing motion and movement and liberated energy, and obviously that's been commodified and turned back against itself. But, you know, the West, or at least, you know, certainly the lefty parts of the West, are much more open, loose, and liberated than they were in Reich's time. And it was really shocking to me to see, if you remember Anders Breivik, in one of the Scandinavian countries, I think Denmark, was the mass shooter.
Oh, this is about 5-8 years ago.
Yeah, 4 or 5 years ago, I think.
Yeah,
where he was this kind of far right fascist mass shooter who released a 1,000-page manifesto calling for the Knights Templar and all this stuff, saying that the West had fallen to kind of degenerate leftist ideals and had become weak to the onslaught of Islam. And one of the biggest people he named in that manifesto was Reich, for being a guiding influence on the West and being more sexually open, loose, and weak from his perspective, which was shocking to me because it's like nobody even talks about Reich.
It's pretty remarkable that he had heard of Reich even.
Right.
Let alone he's quoting Reich as being some kind of influence, when I think you could go around to 10,000 people on the street and say, who's Wilhelm Reich? And nobody would know who you were talking about, even though his influence, that's the thing. His influence has been great. You asked him, if you asked Timothy Leary, who is Wilhelm Reich? He could probably have given you a couple of hours of talk about his work. Robert Anton Wilson.
But even things like Rolfing or the human potential movement or alternative therapies or energy therapy.
All of this stuff, just the idea that you have an energy in yourself and that's very important that it gets to flow. Just that fundamental concept that you have this energy in you, and it's very prana yoga-esque. But again, Wilhelm Reich was not, if you talk to, you look at his work, he was coming at it from the most sort of material, like he wouldn't want you to use this word, but materialist scientific basis for coming to these things. And yet he was coming to these same conclusions that there is an energy within our bodies. It's not just our blood and our nerves. There's something else, the way that our bodies work. And making sure that that gets to move around the way it would like to and does not get stopped by either our minds or our bodies is essential to really being healthy.
And it's like the Force from Star Wars, basically.
It sort of is. I mean, without this, I mean, I'm very annoyed as a, an older person who saw the first couple of few Star Wars, or actually, I think I only ever saw the first episode, or episode 4 now, as they call it. But anyways, but the Force being a something passed on genetically as a lineage,
right?
The way it is now offends me, my sensibilities.
As opposed to being ambient there for everybody.
As something that every individual could develop for themselves and is based on nothing except for how you carry yourself, allow yourself to be.
Right. You sent me a couple years ago, Reich's book, Either God and Devil, which was great. And
And Cosmic Superimposition.
Yes. And that was really eye-opening for me because his attitude was so practical. He basically, he rejects, as he calls it, both the mechanistic view of society and also the mystical view. He was very opposed to any mystic ideas or occulty or what we would now call New Agey ideas. And he said that both the mechanistic view of reality, or what we might now call scientist materialism.
Material chemical, as if everything is limited to that pure, that single realm of chemical interactions.
Right. And he thought that both of these, the mechanistic and the mystical view of reality, were just dodges. They were ways for people to escape their own bodies, basically, and the just the fact that they were living and alive in this, in this cosmic process that we're all going through. And so he thought that both the whole history of mysticism and religion and of materialism and the mechanistic view of things were just dodges from reality.
They are. They're ways to avoid sensation, in a way. The truth of this incredible energy that maybe that's saying too much, but I think most people at some time in their life had some kind of experience, whether it was like a mutual orgasm or some kind of, psychedelic experience, which I think can open up a lot of these things for people, though they can also, you have to be worried about being sucked into a black hole when you journey too far. Or taking it too literally. None of these things, all of these things, everything that we think is a creation of our mind. So you always have to be skeptical. Is your mind creating something as a way of avoiding facing a truth?
Right. And I guess Reich would say, it's also a creation of the body. And we're often, like he would say, when people are doing mystical practices or occult practices, what they're really feeling is their organ sensations. When they're claiming to feel these expanded or enlightening states, what they're really feeling is their body, you know, their body doing different things. And certainly psychedelics, you know, all the visions and things can certainly be expressions of the body or the internal world of the body. Or if you're clenched down, or not letting not letting your energy flow freely in a trip, you know, like the bad trip experience is produced by, you know, the body clenching down on itself in a way.
Well, that's
not breathing properly.
That's what fear is, essentially. You know, fear is not wanting to face something, essentially. You know, if it's like whatever is there, you can't deny it. If you're afraid of it, you will try and crawl into a ball and compress yourself. And if you're not allowing yourself to recognize reality, then you'll probably just walk in the middle of the street and get hit by a car. You know, those are the extremes, but these are the sorts of things that we always have to, as beings, you know, we have to walk these crazy lines, and we're stumbling towards some knowledge. But
right,
I think his, you know, one of his big things was that these two branches, and it relates to, you know, Satan and Jesus, sort of. I mean, that was the ether god devil thing. It's the ether is this pure energy. It's not really related. It hasn't been interpreted yet. And that the two interpretations of it are God and the devil. And these are like two mystical ways of viewing it. And they, neither of them is true. They are both constructs. But they are just ways that we process as making do with the information we get. Because it's really hard to understand when all of a sudden you feel all kinds of sensations and flows in your body. And like, what is that? It's an ecstatic experience. But does it need to be related to any concept, or can it just be exactly what it is?
Right. And that's sometimes just too scary to face. Because of our armoring and our character and our past and our mental constructs that are put on us by society, sometimes the hardest thing to do is just to be. And I think at the high reaches of spirituality, whether we're talking about, you know, the non-dual traditions, or even something like Eckhart Tolle or something like that, where people are saying, you know, no, just embrace reality as it is right now. Don't create these mental castles of these, you know, palaces in the air of these mythologies that people have been creating all throughout history to explain their experience, you know, and just embrace what's happening, you know, and don't try to put a Band-Aid on it by creating a story around it, or put a Band-Aid on it by trying to change it. Just feel it and accept it in a way.
I think it's a very difficult thing to do. I mean, when you start to do that, you know, I've had a couple of like complete body breakdowns and emotional breakdowns in my life, and they're horrible, painful moments.
Yes, yes.
But at the same time, once you pass through, you sense things and can feel things in a way that you didn't before, because all of a sudden you opened up. It's like opening up floodgates, and it's, you know,
yeah, I definitely have had that experience.
A whole bunch of stuff gets washed away.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's sad enough just like putting out books on the sidewalk when you have your entire library washed away down a river in front of you. It's a really hard thing to take.
Mm-hmm.
But then you stand there and you go, oh, actually, I never needed those things anyways.
Right, right. So I really think that Reich is somebody who needs to be reevaluated, and it can be tough going with him, because a lot of his views maybe considered politically incorrect in our current time period. And also he did kind of, you know, he was under so much attack towards the end that, you know, some of his later work is very
gets paranoid.
And he's talking about, there's parts where he's thinking he might be an alien, and, you know.
Well, I mean, I think that was, you know, that statement is maybe misinterpreted, because okay, it is true that, you know, later, I mean, he went through an incredible evolution if you read all of his work, going from basically a psychiatrist to getting pure radium from the government to do experiments on eliminating radioactivity through the manipulation of orgone energy. And so he took, I hope I'm not getting any of this wrong, but he took needles of pure radium, which is like incredibly radioactive, and he had to be careful and sign all kinds of forms to be able to get access to this radium. I mean, this is the 50s. And put it inside in one of his orgone accumulators, which you can read about, and Hawkwind has a song about, but basically...
Well, let's go, let's touch on that first before the radium experiment, because let's bridge from what we were talking about to the idea that he really started to, like, he saw this energy as something that could be literally harnessed with devices and outside of the body.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I have to say, it's like, I've never figured out exactly how he got the step to creating the orgone accumulator, but I would assume that it had something to do with looking at the structure of the earth, and that there's this concept of layers to things, and even cell walls and cell membranes are these layers of more permeable and less permeable materials. And he ended up developing what's called the orgone accumulator, which is basically like a box or other device or other shape, but generally a box that's organic material and then a layer of metal, preferably iron or a ferromagnetic material, then organic, then metal, then organic, then metal. So slightly decreasing in size until in the very middle you have a metal layer, and inside of that the energy, this orgone energy, he found would be concentrated. And coming from a very materialistic background, I mean, my father was a science teacher and stuff, I've created a mechanistic sort of electrostatic model for how that actually could work just at that level, in that the outermost layer of metal has a certain surface area. If that charge gets transferred into the next layer as a capacitor, that's smaller. So now the same amount of charge has been concentrated into a smaller space, therefore the charge is concentrated. And that just keeps on going. Basically, it's like a spherical shaped capacitor where the innermost layer has the highest charge, because now the charge distribution is concentrated. And then he took that energy and applied it to various experiments with himself. And I had a crazy, what are those things called when it happens only once? I'm losing my anecdotal experience with an orgone accumulator, which freaked me out severely, but I could never shake.
What was that experience?
Well, back in my 20s when I had some friends and we were all reading, there was like basically three of us, two brothers and myself, who were reading all this Reich and reproducing experiments of Reich. And just like, we were so fascinated by this work as being at one side scientific, on the other side appealed, I think, to this deeper sense in ourselves that you can feel other things about the world.
Yes.
That people ascribe to all kinds of mystical stuff, yet we didn't want to get involved in this sort of like vague mystical namby-pamby stuff.
Yes.
So it was like a nice bridge for this. You know, as you said, Ether God Devil like talks about this from the psychological viewpoint. So I built an orgone accumulator, and it's very important that you use them according to Reich. You need to read his stuff, because you should never use an orgone accumulator like on a hazy day or a rainy day.
Okay.
Because the accumulator actually will work in reverse on those days.
Ooh.
And either
I zapped myself that way once. It was not a pleasant experience.
Yeah, if you use it on a hazy day, what you're concentrating is basically all the bad energy that's in the atmosphere.
I did that when the next 24 hours I had the worst headache and migraine, full body migraine in my life, and I had to get somebody to come give me like an injection of like anti migraine medication to like even get off the floor. It was not fun. But I felt great afterwards.
Well, that's the thing. These are all things. I mean, I think just the same way, it's sort of like, you know, you do a heroic drug experience, you come out the other side and you're like, wow, okay, I feel better, but that was really hurt.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so, but during that process, I got down to some emotional stuff that was, you know, extremely, extremely deep-seated, so.
Well, that's good. Not the best, not the nicest way of getting there.
It was not fun, though.
and not to do it on rainy days, but to ideally only do it on, you know, beautiful days. And everybody recognizes, like, sunny, clear, pure blue skies, puffy white clouds, you know, these, the day that everyone would goes, oh, that's a beautiful day. And these are ideas that I think are widely recognized. Some people like rainy days, but nobody's going to say, oh yeah, rainy days are pretty.
Right.
You right. like them for other things, for emotional contents that they give you or resonances, but you will need to pick a really beautiful day where the sky is open and clear and you can just feel that all around you there's this life energy-ness. And you take that and you use the box then. So I used it on myself, and when I was that age, I guess I was like 22 or something like that, I had two moles on my face. And these were like typical dark colored moles that grew like extra dense hairs, sort of like witchy hairs coming out of them. And so I used the orgone accumulator and had a metal coil coming out of it so that you could apply it. So you could take the energy from the middle and then sort of direct it out of the box and put it in specific places. So I applied it to my face. And I was sort of goofing around because while at the same time we were doing this investigation, the skeptic in me was always like, yeah, yeah, this is just like, we're just goofing around and this is silliness and it's just an...
That's healthy to have.
You know, this is just an entertainment for me.
Yes.
It's like instead of, I don't know, doing something else. Video games hadn't hardly been invented yet by then. But anyways...
Hard to imagine now that people actually had to come up with their own entertainment.
Yes, playing cards was like, that's a thing people did.
Right, right.
But I applied it to my face, and about 2 hours after the application, my moles swelled up to the size of like golf balls or like larger than peas. Like these, like they swelled up terribly. And I started freaking out because... You know, those kinds of dark moles are, I think, fairly widely recognized as potential precancerous situations in people's bodies already. You know, that's a fairly well-documented sort of medical thing to worry about.
They can be.
They can be.
But not necessarily.
Not necessarily. But I mean,
I think it depends on the shape and the you know, there's definitely ways to spot that. But
right. But I mean, there are places to watch out for.
Mm-hmm.
So they swell up, and I'm freaking because I'm like, oh no, I did something with this stupid orgone accumulator that's now going to give me cancer. And they swelled up, and then over the course of the day, they actually went down again and sort of like dissipated. And in the back of my mind, I'm going, okay, so it's like metastasized already.
Oh, no.
I'll be dead in a week or something like that. Oh, well, it's been nice so far, so I can't complain, you know. But strangely, what happened was when they shrunk, the moles were no longer dark colored. While my body still had this memory where there's sort of like a slight lump in that location, both of those moles were then, after that day, the same color as the rest of my skin.
Hmm.
It's like it had forced out the potentially cancery part of the mole. Where it went, I don't know, but I mean, I'm a relatively healthy individual. I've never been like diagnosed with anything, so knock wood. You know, it was all good, but that sort of freaked me out because it was the first time that I had seen or felt so clearly the potential power of a ridiculously simple device.
Yes.
And I sort of warn people, it's like, and it's the same way that, you know, in a number of your posts, you warn against like goofing with magic too much sometimes. It's like
certain parts of it, yeah.
You know, it's just like, be careful.
Yes.
People, don't just do craziness and not expect craziness to come back at you.
Right, right.
And doing this, playing with this and having this happen to me kind of freaked me out because it was like, wow, wait. If all of this is true, if this is exactly the way he described it and has the power that he described it, this is something that people need to be careful with because you could hurt somebody. I mean, you know, when they took this radium later in his in Organon in Rangeley, near Rangeley, Maine, which is where he had his...
So that was his kind of his... He set up his whole scientific facility.
Exactly. There's sort of like a small community up there.
Okay.
Where they could do research, and it was like isolated from everybody, so they wouldn't have to worry about hurting
anybody. As referenced in the Kate Bush song, Cloud Busting.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Where that's a great one to watch because it's got
Sutherland, Donald Sutherland.
Donald Sutherland plays Wilhelm Reich, and Kate Bush plays his son during the crackdown, the FDA crackdown.
Yeah, and there's a book by Wilhelm Reich saying, which actually the Book of Dreams, I believe it's called, which I've never read.
Oh, Peter Reich.
Peter Reich.
Yes. Yeah. I haven't read that either, but I hear it's good.
Yes, but I mean, you know, you have to take it with. This was a child's perception of what was going on during that time. So I'm sure it's fascinating from that. But so Reich had these organ accumulators, and he built larger ones that where people could sit in. And William S. Burroughs refers to them a number of times in his works.
Yes,
especially in The Job, I think.
Yeah, Burroughs loved to sit in them, writing, smoking keef, and masturbating.
I think he says that it was he had his first hands-free orgasm by just sitting on an organ accumulator, because just like all that energy will get you charged up crazy.
So.
And you better release it, otherwise it's going to find a way of manifesting itself.
So it's got the William Burroughs stamp of approval.
So Wilhelm Reich had all these accumulators and stuff, and got a needle of pure radium, put it inside an organ accumulator, and basically caused havoc on his site. Almost everybody immediately got incredibly sick, sort of like your experience with playing with one on a bad weather day.
Yes, I also left it on for like 12 hours or something. It was an organ blanket I'd made.
Oh, but it was it was like not a nice day.
I don't think so, no. And yeah, I mean, who knows? And these days with power lines and things like that, and who knows what's going on in the... electromagnetic, you know, cell phone towers and all of this.
Right. I mean, the accumulation of all this stuff going on around us, I think we really have no appreciation for, and we probably won't for a century or two.
Until it's too late.
Yeah, that's usually the way it works.
Right.
You know? But, so he took this radium needle, put it in the organ accumulator, and basically caused such a huge, excited field, which wasn't radiation as such, because, I mean... There would be no cause for an increase of radiation like that.
Sure.
But somehow the combination of the radium and a strong orgone field created what he called DOR, or deadly orgone radiation, which is sort of like the negative orgone radiation, the dark force.
The dark side of the force.
Yes, exactly. That made everyone sick, horribly sick, and they didn't know what to do. And so eventually one of them just had to brave it and managed to get the radium needle back out of the organ accumulator, put it in a lead case, back in its lead case, and buried it just to get rid of it. And it took something like a week or 2 weeks to get this sort of like miasma of sickness out of the location, opening up all the organ accumulators, basically dismantling them so that they would not continue to have these fields, so that they could just dissipate.
This sounds like the beginning of a science fiction movie when the scientific team unlocks an unspeakable force from
and
zombies or Cthulhu or the Thing arrives,
which are all in manifestations of sensations within us.
There you go.
You know, what does Cthulhu represent?
Yes. Yeah. Well, a lot of literary critics thought it was H.P. Lovecraft's fear of his own body and fear of sexuality.
There you go. I mean, I think they're not too far off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just all this repression is like darkness and evilness and X-Files, black oil, all
right.
Of this stuff. You know, the commonalities of these representations, I don't think is any accident. And probably Carl Jung would have had a lot to say if they had had a chance to interact more.
Yes.
But then they went back after it had been this radium was sitting in the ground, and they pulled it out, and the radium was not radioactive anymore, which the Atomic Energy Commission was very interested in,
huh?
Because they were like, wait.
I didn't know that part of the story.
Yes.
Okay.
We drop atomic bombs on places, and yet somehow we could de-radioactify these places. That would be really handy, because then we could probably...
Then we could move there.
Yeah, then we could drop more bombs and fix it up and get, right. Get our people
build
back.
Build some condos.
Exactly. Okay, this is our terrible cynical sides coming out
well,
at this point. Or, real, I mean, or
that
realist.
Was, that was why the neutron bomb was developed, in theory.
Yeah. No, the neutron bomb is kind of genius when you look at it from a purely pragmatic viewpoint.
Yes. And
as long as you're not...
From the Dr. Strangelove perspective.
Exactly. As long as you're not worried about people's... individual experiences.
Right.
But yeah, so he did this experiment with a needle, and it was like, and he was astounded too. He had no expectation of this happening. He was like, this is crazy. It's not radioactive anymore. But then when he used this needle, it would actually excite, now it would excite the organ accumulators in a positive way. It's like he had flipped the radium from being dark radiation to some kind of lighter radiation or like life-affirming radiation.
Huh.
And then at the same time, he was using the Cloud Busters, as mentioned in the Kate Bush song, which were a way of, again, from my mechanistic viewpoint, it's a way of sucking charge from an area into the Earth, which is, because of the water table, et cetera, is essentially an insane reservoir of charge, because you could fit incredible amounts of electrical charge in the Earth. So you suck the energy from one area. Now it has a void of that energy. So now the energy is going to try and flow into that vacuum that you created. Now you create an energy flow from everywhere else to that place.
Mm.
Using this technique, Wilhelm Reich started manipulating weather and bringing rain to areas that were arid in the United States. And this is, again, like, you know, some people would say this is just ridiculous. Everyone
yeah,
knows.
It's one of those things where you hear it and it does sound ridiculous, and it sounds so out there and so far-fetched that you know, the immediate response is, okay, sure. And then if you dig a little deeper and you start to read a bit more about it, then the next response is like, why wasn't I taught this in school? Why don't I even at least know about this and have the ability or the opportunity to decide for myself whether this was a valid thing or not? Why is it just completely scrubbed from the historical record to some extent?
His books were burned. I mean, it's kind of crazy to think of that they decided that all of his material should not be known by anybody. And you actually have to be a little cautious with the reprints. If you're buying Wilhelm Reich books, you should look to get as early an edition as possible always, because there has been editing done since then. Subtle editing granted, but there has been editing done.
And that's out of fear of, I think the remaining Reichians are a little bit afraid of persecution, so they've tried to sanitize it a bit. Is that the case?
On the one side, and yet on the other side, if you start to go on to YouTube stuff related to Wilhelm Reich, there are a bunch of people that I consider complete kooks.
Well, there's the whole organite thing, which is total nonsense and not connected.
Well, and then they borrowed a word that Reich used, because during some of these experiments with iridium and stuff like that, he found strange powdery mineral deposits around these areas of extreme charge. And he called one of these materials organite.
Okay.
But these people on YouTube are like taking crystals and putting them in bunches and like saying that these are like now orgone devices. Wilhelm Reich, if you read all of his stuff, he never mentions quartz crystals as being anything special or some kind of thing. And I'm not saying that they're not. I'm just saying this does not relate to Wilhelm Reich's written, documented work.
Yes. Okay.
And then I consider it just like crazy, kooky money-making myself.
So if somebody wants to get into or maybe try some, with the caveat that you've already mentioned of being careful, if somebody wanted to try to look into some of Reich's theories on their own at home with maybe some do-it-yourself home science experiments, where would you guide them?
I mean, ideally, you want to read all of his work, because as a body, to read it, to understand how he got from one place to another, it all sort of leads quite logically to these places. But I mean, either God, devil is, I think, a great social analysis book, and for human psychology to really understand, to get a, some kind of like objective perspective on it. And I think that's what he was aiming for. It's like, wait, what is the fundamental? What is underneath this all? What is the part that we are interpreting? And what's the part underneath the interpretation? Was sort of like the goal of that. And, but Function of the Orgasm is a great book.
Okay.
Or, I'm forgetting the titles now.
Mass Psychology of Fascism?
Mass Psychology of Fascism. Well, that got him in a lot of trouble because, you know, he just, it was just like, look at this. This is so obvious. This is sexual repression. People are taking out their anger of their repression on other people. I mean, he also wrote the, not Sexual Liberation, Children of the Future.
Okay.
Where he got in a lot of trouble again by suggesting that young people have sexual urges.
All right, so those are the good ones.
Yeah, I know I'm missing some, and where we are, I can't get a signal, so I can't go onto Amazon and Google all of his work.
He wrote a lot of stuff, though, and I've definitely not gone through all of it, but you really think that...
I mean, Selected Writings is a great book.
Okay.
Because that just gives you sort of an overview. But I know I'm missing one, and I wish I could remember its title. But Function of the Orgasm is a great book as well.
Character analysis?
Character analysis. That's more on the psychology end, where he just looked at, again, like his work ended up being influential, I think, on so many psychologists in terms of even the like transactional analysis.
Yes.
And this, all of this kind of work where it's like, wait, let's not just get into people's, you know, like fall down their rabbit hole. But let's look, try and get an objective view into how these energies between people are relating. How are people interacting? How does that progress? What's the evolution? And how do we interrupt that and try and guide it into a more positive way?
Okay. Fascinating stuff. And so I'm one other thing I definitely want to talk about is your involvement with the Temple of Psychic Youth. And I think maybe some of your work with Reich led you on to Topi stuff.
I mean, I think they were connected, even though, you know, there was this posse of me and these two twin brothers in Toronto, and there were some other people. But for me, it was like the three of us, this triumvirate, who were doing this research. And they never really got into Topi, but they were not occult. Culturally inclined at all.
Okay.
They were coming from a very scientific background. Both of them ended up getting like masters or maybe even PhDs in, you know, physics, very dry sort of people. But I keep, you know, we're still friends and we keep in touch. And I think they understand, though they were all both very into Carlos Castaneda.
Oh, okay.
And
that's
his
pretty
work.
Out there.
It's pretty out there. And it was funny.
It's more out there than Reich.
It sort of is. But yeah. At the same time, I think it acknowledges itself as being out there.
Okay.
You know, it doesn't pretend not to be personal spiritual journeys.
Right.
And so manifestations.
There's not a danger of the kind of pseudoscience.
Well, I think that's the whole thing. It's like, as soon as you say that something, start to say that something is true.
Yes.
You're in trouble.
Right. Yes.
You know, it's not about it being true or not true. Most things, I think, for us, it's like, does it resonate with you? Can it take you someplace that will make you feel better and more alive?
Right. Is it subjectively useful?
Exactly. Exactly. And let's not get too hung up on it being a true truth, like it's some kind of crystal absolute floating in the universe. Because
which it could be. You never know.
It could be.
But yes.
You know, it could be. And there's everything, you know, quantum mechanics dictates everything is true. Everywhere. All the time. Simultaneously. It makes no sense. Don't worry about it.
Right.
But Topi, I ended up getting involved with through another friend of mine who I think just sort of, I think he sort of broke Topi rules. First, he played Dreams Less Sweet for me, which I found fascinating.
Psychic TV album?
Yeah, Psychic TV's second album.
Okay.
And I had already been studying electroacoustic music composition, so I found it really interesting coming from that angle because it's pretty much the most abstract album. It's a weird mix of just like location recording and music of such a wide range. It's quite incredible.
Right. So for those who are listening who might not know, the Temple of Psychic Youth was kind of the extension of the band Psychic TV in the 80s and the work of Genesis Peorage, or it began that way. And it was the idea of creating a kind of a loose-knit, non-hierarchical, occultural group to investigate ideas of magic or personal liberation.
Yeah, at the time, there is the Grey Book, T-H-E-E, Grey, G-R-E-Y, book, that you can now find on the internet any place, I'm pretty sure, if you just Google it.
Or in the Psychic Bible.
Or in the Psychic Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. But at the time, it was a limited print thing that was only supposed to be held by TOPI members and distributed by them individually with people that they thought they could really trust to hand this to. And basically the book says, listen, nothing is true. Don't worry about it being true, but all of these symbols, all of the gods, demons, everything that we've ever imagined in this whole mystical realm, accept them as basically imagery playthings for our minds to wrap our heads around different feelings and ideas and concepts and stuff. You know, like Thor, lightning. Okay, cool.
Right.
You know, there's storms. Let's give a god for storms because, like, these things happen and they're really powerful, influential things. So let's just, like, name a god after that. I don't think the Greeks and most Greeks ever believed that those gods were real in a physical sense, the way that human beings are. They represent concepts and they're ways of people playing out sort of like chess with ideas and stories with ideas of, you know, intentions and energies and these sorts of things, and accept them for that, what that is. And then that was sort of like the main part. And the other one, another fundamental thing about TOPI was look at yourself, look at your life, really, really deeply recognize it. Don't judge. There's no reason. All of us are pathetic, flawed creatures. Let's just accept that now and not stress about it. But moving from there, what do you really want in life? When you say you want money, what is the money for? You know, what do you really, really want? And try and reject what society has told you you should want in these things. What do you really, really, really deeply look for to make your life a quality life? And once you've done that and stripped away all these other things, go, okay, I'm going to make this happen. I'm not going to let something stand in my way. Why am I letting things stand in my way for the things that I really want? And then there was the ritual of the three liquids,
mm-hmm.
which was based very heavily on the work of Austin Osman Spare.
Yes.
I don't know if you've done any previous podcasts regarding Spare's work.
I've written about Spare on Ultra Culture, but Spare is fascinating. He was the person who invented, he was an artist in South London in around the turn of the century, who was a contemporary of Crowley, but took a very different tack and was much more interested in personal artistic expression and doing magic through art. But he was the inventor of the sigil technique, which was the idea of condensing a desire into a symbol that is you can use to talk directly to your unconscious with and bypass the conscious mind and conscious dialogue completely.
Yeah, and the Temple of Psychic Youth use this sigil technique where basically you take an intention and ideally you condense it into not I want something. Because whenever you have a corollary like I want, there's also always the sort of the negative of it. Or it's like I need something. It's like, well, you don't need it or you're not going to get it sort of thing. Instead, manifest it as if it's already happened.
Mm.
I am this. This exists. Like, you know, I am wealthy, if that was what you want, though. I mean, you know, personally, that's definitely pretty low on my list. There's way things higher to me than that.
Okay.
But, you know, what is wealth for? Except for to help my friends or something like that. So therefore, it's like, wait, I want my friends to have the things that they want. I want my friends to be happy. That, so my friends are happy.
Okay.
You know, which is sort of vague, granted.
But then why do you want your friends to be happy?
Because it makes me feel good.
So you want to feel good.
I want to feel good. So I could okay. maybe do a sigil for that.
In
I
what
feel
specific
good.
Way do you want to feel good?
Every way.
Every way. Okay.
Every way. Just like all those spikes sticking out of the planet.
There you go. Okay.
So you take the letters. I mean, you know, the traditional thing is you write down all the letters, cross out duplications because, well, that's a duplication. We only need one A. It represents anus.
Yes.
Oops. Pun not intended.
And this is all the stuff I put in the ebook, the free ebook you can get from Ultra Culture. Shows how to do the sigil technique.
Right. And then there's where the sex magic comes in, which is where some people get a little like queasy, though I don't know why. It's not like everybody doesn't do it. Not everybody's. There are asexual people out there, and good for them if they enjoy that and that makes them feel good.
Mm.
But basically, the concept is that you masturbate while doing it. You cut yourself while doing it.
Be safe.
Be safe, yes. Sterilize and don't share knives with people whose blood you don't know. And I think all of this was to basically be transgressive and take you to a place that you'd never been before.
There was also adding the hair and...
You could have hair, spit.
It was just like, it was like getting like some DNA, like a DNA link to yourself.
Exactly. Which actually connects with a whole radionics theme that maybe we'll do another podcast
okay.
about.
But it definitely forms a magical link to your own, to yourself, basically.
Right.
Right. Through your...
I mean, your blood is your blood.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else's blood is like your blood. It has your DNA in it. It's yours. I think that's a thing. Your spit is yours. You know, your cum, whatever kind, or fluid, your body fluids
mm-hmm.
are yours. So those really link you to this idea. And ideally, the part of it, the sigil thing, is to forget what you actually intended. So it's sort of good to make a sigil and let it sit around so long that you maybe don't even yes. remember what it was yes. for.
So you leave it on a shelf for like 3 weeks and then you pick it up and say, what was this for?
What was
and
this for?
That's
like,
when you, that's
I
when
don't
you do
know.
The ritual.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Let's use it now because if you're not thinking about a desire, then you can't be thinking about how you can't achieve yes. this desire.
You can't overthink it or undermine it.
That's the whole thing, is to try and get into the subconscious place. Your subconscious remembers everything and it remembers it, and it just ignoring it and just letting it go. So you perform the sigil of the three liquids, and that was sort of the core of Topi, was this, the sigil of the three liquids combined with this sort of acceptance of all of these mythical images, etc., for being mythical images. I wish I could quote the opening chapter of the Grey Book, but basically, you know, cuts to the core of that. And I think it was Monte Cazaza and Jen and maybe somebody else, Peter Christopherson,
okay.
who put that together. But Jen could tell you better, I'm sure. But yeah, so I got involved in Topi because I just found it really interesting and fun and a good way of trying to cut through myself and refine myself. You know, I've sort of like really loved Nietzsche and this idea of diamond, which was sort of taken by the Nazis to some crazy fascist extreme, but at an individual level, to try and hone yourself down to being like, so you can just be present with yourself and you don't have a lot of baggage going through your mind and cluttering it up all the time. And that idea just really appealed to me personally. So I was involved in Topi for a number of years, and me and some friends were sort of like ran the Canadian access point, as they called it. And we had a picnic and socials and this and that.
And this is all before the internet, obviously.
Yeah, this is totally during the height of the zine world.
This is really interesting to me because, you know, when I was first getting into magic was when the internet was just, or the web was just happening. So there was access to information, and you know, there were, it was the 90s, so you could go to Barnes & Noble or Borders and get at least, you know, basic books on chaos magic, or you know, Llewellyn books or Weiser books. And there was definitely information available. I mean, compared to now, there's no comparison whatsoever as to how much information is available now. But there was certainly, there was a fair amount of accessibility. You still really had to dig for the good stuff. It was easy to get the kind of the fluff or the easy stuff to get, but you really had to dig, or go into the library system or get photocopies of things, or, you know, really hunt for more of the in-depth information. But I'm really interested to hear about the pre-internet era of when there wasn't even, you know, there was no web access, and it was kind of like people photocopying.
I mean, there, I guess
the,
there was
other.
Limited web back then. There was BBSs.
Okay.
And ARPANET had come to help libraries connect each other, I think, by that time.
Okay.
Because this would have been 87, 88, 89, up to 90-ish, that time period. So there was very, but it was very limited, let's face it. I mean, it wasn't like, I was an oddball in that I had BBS access, and I was one of the first people that knew had a modem.
Right. Well, and I guess there was CompuServe and America Online, you know, and these were all things that I was on at the time too.
Yeah, but this is probably 10 years, you know, I think it's about a 10-year pre.
Well, even I remember CompuServe in 1989 and BBSs, but I don't know how extensive it was.
Yeah, it was fairly limited. And most of that sort of stuff was the fact sheet 5.
Yes.
The era of fact sheet 5 and the zines. You know, I was in my mid 20s by that time. I was actually like borderline too old to join Topi when I did, because I was so old.
So it was definitely like a teenage, or
that was sort of the appeal, and I think there was supposed to be sort of a big cutoff at 24 or 20, like after you finished your 23rd year.
Okay.
That you, you know, like, oh, now you're too old, don't trust anybody over 30 kind of thing. But my friend, who was, you know, like 5 or 6 years younger than me, considered me trustworthy for this kind of thing. And, but I think one of the beauties of that time was that, A, it was people's personal experiences that they were writing down. Like people, there was like sigil books where people would like write down, this is what I did, these were the ideas I had, this is how I made it manifest. Because a lot of us, I think, did stuff that included like audio cut-ups, video cut-ups to a limited sense, all kinds of sensory overload, just to try and take you to a place where you were not thinking anymore and you could just do instead. And so the zines were good for that. And also, I think one of the things about the internet is there is so much, there's a lot more wheat, or there's a lot more chaff.
A lot more chaff, yeah.
Like, it's like the hay pile is huge. There are the same number of needles in that haystack as there always have been.
Right, and they might be easier to get to, but they've also, it's, information has been devalued now. It's a supply and demand thing. When there's infinite supply, there's very little demand. I mean, I remember when I had to hunt for 6 months for a copy of a book, it really meant something when I got it.
Right.
You know, or I had to pay, you know, some ungodly amount of money or photocopy every single individual. You know, or even now when I'm, work that I'm doing now, research on magic, where I'm having to go to university libraries and get things out of special collections and things like that. It's like, that really means something, you know, when it's not available in the, you know, just in a PDF somewhere, you know, in a PDF collection.
No, it's not the same. I don't think you value it the same. I think it's, that's the problem, is when it's all in the same media or the same medium, that being in the same medium equates them all.
Hmm.
Whereas I remember getting a library card for the University of Toronto, even though I wasn't a student at the University of Toronto, I paid like $250. This is like, you know, back in 1980-something dollars.
Wow.
You know, to get a card so that I could access the rare book stacks, which is where I could actually get occult books, like, from printings from turn of the century and this sort of thing,
right,
and see them in their original form.
What were the big gems you found in there?
I don't even remember. I've forgotten so much, but you know, I hope I absorb it in my body.
Okay.
I don't remember the titles anymore. But you know,
probably stuff that you can just get a, you know, just Google and get a PDF of now.
Yeah. What am I thinking? There's one that used to have like great diagrams that related to the John Dee stuff. That was all like the Necronomicon, which is just like a goofy piece of crap kind of.
Right.
But all the diagrams in the Necronomicon were taken from the Greater Key of Solomon, I think, or almost all of them.
The Simon Necronomicon, the little paperback one that came out in the
70s. The little paperback one.
So that one is, I found out the story about that one is hilarious. As apparently it's written up in the book, in the Center of the Fire by James Wasserman, who's an OTO guy. And apparently it was him and one other guy just getting drunk above the, they lived above the Magical Child in New York or something like that. And
right.
Them getting drunk and making it up.
No, so, but those sigils.
They're not from the, I don't think they're from the Key of Solomon. They're, I don't think, I haven't seen them other places. They were supposed to be Sumerian, or maybe they put some stuff in there.
In the Necronomicon, they say that they're Sumerian. But if you look back, they relate to like key diagrams on some of John Dee's tablets.
Oh.
And like tracing out.
I know the diagram you're talking about.
Yeah.
Where it's the connections between the pyramids.
Right. And yeah. Drawing out between the numbers and the different tiles or whatever you want to call them,
right,
on the board, they strongly relate to that.
Okay, I'll have to go back and look.
And
very sneaky.
And the Goetia.
Okay, well, I really think that, you know, like, definitely at least up until now, the whole process of getting into magic in the Western magical tradition is definitely a big part of it has been like the library hunt and the paper chase. And even if you go back to the Golden Dawn, you know, the Golden Dawn was formed by people who were, you know, like Mathers, who were just hanging out in the British Library, unearthing all these old manuscripts and saying, what is this stuff? And then trying to piece it together and coming up with a fairly admirable synthesis of material. And now it's kind of like that same, it's almost like an archetypal image of somebody going into the library and finding the forbidden book.
It is, right? But I think, you know, that was one of the things about the zine age was that people were looking for jewels and sharing the jewels amongst each other. People didn't want to just be, it wasn't that easy. I mean, it would cost money to print out booklets, you know, like real money. You know, you're out $2 just because you wanted to print out a booklet. So you think a little longer and harder about that than posting something on Instagram, which takes literally a click.
Right.
You know, and doesn't cost you a penny and all of this. So it was very different. I think it was just, and same with those older books. I mean, the older, back then, can you imagine publishing a book? You have to really think that what you're saying is worth it, worth spending that money on. And you want to make, I think it's just like a matter of pride. It's like you'd want the content to be concise,
right?
You know, informative, cutting to the bone. This is what I want you to know, you know. Whereas now there's just, as I said, it's just like there's so much hay to go through. They were just all like swimming in it all the time, and finding those jewels becomes more difficult.
Yeah, and I definitely find the occult discourse online is not particularly interesting to me for the most of it, you know. Is not particularly interesting or cutting edge in the way that Topi was. And I remember talking to Phil Hine at one point, saying that in the late 80s, he attended, the chaos magician Phil Hine, in the late 80s, he attended like the Oxford Thelemic Symposium or something like that, which was like a very, as he described it, like a very stuffy kind of dry academic, you know, occult conference, and the Topi people came and showed a video of a sex magic action taking place, and that everyone kind of, you know, kind of descended into giggling and were kind of didn't quite have the maturity to handle like a sex magic action actually seeing it happen, as opposed to reading about it in an academic sense. And well, maybe you will give that to you in 10 years at an advanced degree or something like
Topi
that.
Topi was freaking gorilla magic. It's just like doing it. And we would do it like under bridges, in forests, wherever we thought was a special place, you know, in, you know, I had friends who would do it in front of churches. You know, they had some gripe with the church. I don't know. People.
Some people do, you know, they have childhood stuff.
That's exactly. And he was working stuff out, which he needed to work out. But I mean, all these kinds of things. It was like, it's taking it to the street. It was like, it was the Occupy Wall Street of magic in that okay. It was just like, let's just do it. Let's just do it. It's not talking. It's not analyzing. And, you know, you can read the old books, but then take those old books and spray them all over the world to try and help as many people as possible shake themselves loose into freedom. I mean, I think that was the key.
Yes.
You know? And it's not, and not even in a, I mean, there's an aggressive quality, but, you know, if you know, if you ever go to a psychic TV concert, I have to say it's like, it's the biggest bunch of softy, hippie sweethearts you're going to come across, even though the music is insanely, can be insanely aggressive. Because that aggression is to bust crap off of you.
Right.
You know, it's not about hurting anybody else. Hurting somebody else rarely moves you up anywhere. What it's about is helping each other and supporting each other. And then, you know, any interview you've done with Jen again, it's mm-hmm. just like, that's all you're going to get from her. Yes. She's just yes. like, she's a big hippie. She's a big hippie who's just angry. It's
right.
angry love for a reason.
Right. Well, it's hard to look at the state of the world and the lack of liberation and lack of freedom, especially the... And not be angry, especially when there were big spikes of potential liberation in the 60s. And then in the late 90s, I think, you know, there was another often coming off the tail end of Topi, or thanks to Topi in many ways, there was a potential for a huge spike of liberation. And I'm thinking about Jen's work, but also people like Doug Rushkoff and Grant Morrison with the Invisibles and the Disinfocon, and that magic was really getting mainstreamed, and there was this real sense of, you know, even movies like The Matrix being out and Fight Club, there was this real sense of that was in the air, and then 9/11 just came and dragged it all back to the fundamentalist, you know, desert god, desert patriarch era. And I have a lot of hope that I feel like right now is potentially another hot point for that type of energy to be, that type of liberatory energy to be back in the culture.
You know, the pendulum swings, and hopefully there's a procession at the same time. I mean, swings back and forth, and slowly we eke ourselves forward or up or something. You know, there's definitely movement to some degrees. You know, there's definitely, like, freedom. The sexual revolution brought a lot about, you know, a lot of sexual freedom, as we talked about earlier. But at the same time, this whole prevalence of porn and sexual addiction.
Right.
It's almost like everyone's fixated on material qualities. It's like, how big is my dick? How many times can I come in a day?
Right.
I know
Reich was very against that type of thing too, and I don't see that as, it seems like sexual liberation and freedom on the surface, but the more one thinks about it, the more it seems like just another form of sexual repression to have porn available, like it's a public service, like it's the water or gas coming through, you know. But it still keeps people from connecting with each other. It turns it into a digital thing.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's wonderful. It's like, it's wonderful for all these things to be out there in concept, but then if people get obsessed and that's like the new black hole that they fall into, you know, and this is like not on the people in the industry. I mean, every individual chooses their own things,
yes.
But that is the danger, that all of a sudden it's like, now you're just obsessed with doing that. What is the how good was your orgasm?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's not nobody's actually, but the thing that is,
it's like fast food versus
slow food or something like that. And it's definitely like fast food, just grabbing a hamburger and eating it in the car, as opposed to having a meal with somebody else.
Yes. With all this dark repression stuff too around it. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, people, it's like, oh yeah, I can watch, you know, like, I don't know, like two trainees fucking a donkey or something like that. I'm just, you know, like, as the most crazy thing. But if there's all kinds of guilt around that,
yes.
still, what kind of sexual liberation is that? I think that's the thing, that the deeper sense of the sexual liberation was that, no, having beautiful relations between people is not something that anybody should be ashamed about.
Mm-hmm.
And getting rid of shame, because shame is pretty much one of the main control devices. Shame and fear are like twins.
Mm.
You know, and is that when people start to feel like, oh yeah, I really need that and want that and stuff like that, but I can't tell anybody what I want or need.
Mm.
That's not sexual freedom. Right. What is that? I don't know what that is. That's horrible.
Well, I'm curious to hear more about the connection, as you see it, between sex and magic, and even if you want to talk about how some of Reich relates to that, and, you know, liberation, and how these things can be a liberatory act or, you know, path.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, for myself, you know, a really wonderful orgasm is a moment where you feel connected to the universe, where you feel your body in a way that you don't even usually allow yourself to feel it. And that is incredibly liberating and magical, in that it gives you a connection to something that you don't usually. It opens up your world. And I think that's really, again, what magic is really about. It's opening up your mind to the world in ways that you wouldn't usually think of it. Connections between things, connotational connections between things that you don't usually have, and then seeing the world in a new way. So it, again, opens yourself up. And Wilhelm Reich's thing was just, again, basically it's just like sexual liberation does not sexual obsession. It means being allowed to feel things, to think things, to explore things without any guilt, without any shame, because that is what we do. We are explorers, and we need to continue to explore. And they're all connected in exactly that sense, that we need to explore ourselves and the world around us. I think it's one of the innate things in human beings that shouldn't be denied. And we have to be very careful that it doesn't get like sort of channeled into these controlled worlds.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I mean, certainly, I definitely see our society as still very, very sexually repressed and controlled, despite all this supposed openness. And, you know, whether it's, and it's not just people like right-wing, super right-wing Christians or ISIS, you know, obviously are a little pent up. But, you know, certainly in you know, how heavily like politicized sex has become and identity has become, and, nobody seems to be really having a good time.
Which is horrible. You know? I mean...
Right.
I mean, I personally, I consider myself a hedonist. Fundamentally, is the only philosophy I can relate to. And that does not mean necessarily libertine or something like this, like crazy orgies all over the place or something like that, because that's not quality of
I think Reich said something about the whole idea of sexual liberation is not... It's not even necessarily promiscuity. It's not like sexual mayhem. It's being able to fully surrender to the orgasm.
Exactly. And surrender to yourself, you know? Surrender to yourself in a certain level of compassion, too, I think is one of the most important things. Compassion and forgiveness for ourselves and to other people. Because, again, I mean, just like we're all just stumbling towards something and we don't even know where we're going. Nobody asked to be here. We just got thrown into existence, you know? So trying to make our way as best we can and help each other make that way to experience this world as positively and growthfully as possible. I think that was one of Reich's things. That's why you saw Orgone Energy as being so fundamental. It's like, wait, this actually helps things be alive, you know? And it's not at a very deep, deep level of being connected to each other, to yourself, and not being in denial about things. I think that, you know, and that's the connection to Topi. It's just like, don't be in denial about anything. It is what it is. I mean, it's, this is what you like. This is what you like. Why would you pretend different? There's no, you can't move forward in denial. You know, there's no place to be. That's what magic is about recognizing these things, I think, within yourself. I mean, Jodorowsky or other people would say, you know, it's turning shit into gold. You're a piece of shit.
Yes.
You need to turn yourself into some gold.
The alchemical process.
All of these things are connected in that they're really just growth in ourselves and amongst ourselves and together as beings, the same way that nature just does it so naturally.
Yes, and kind of embracing the life wave. I mean, it's almost like the connection between, or the difference between, like a sunflower that's allowed to grow naturally in the sunlight with proper watering and that, or that's put in like a wire box that can only be stunted and grow up to a certain kind of bonsai level, or maybe the difference between a free animal and one that's raised in a factory farm, right? You know, I look around at the world and the way the world has become, and it looks like a factory farm to me for people.
Yeah, I think unfortunately it sort of is. Or you see pets. I was watching one of these pet, you know, like crazy cats that are super vicious show.
I can't remember what it's called. I love those shows.
Okay, but I mean, again, it's like you look and it's like, wow, it's so simple, sort of. It's like this animal is having one of its needs not fulfilled. You know, like the people come home at the end of the day and don't play with it. It's been sitting there alone all day. These people come home and are so busy with their lives that they have to make dinner and this stuff like this. So the cat's going crazy and like clawing at their feet and like knocking things over. And it's like, seriously, you had to think too much about that? I mean, come on.
Yeah, so I saw this one show like that was about a cat in the Midlands in the UK and Yorkshire or something like that. And they referred to it as the butcher of the Midlands because this one like long-haired, you know, fluffy kind of cat had single-handedly depopulated the entire county of all wildlife, of like all birds or squirrels or anything like that. And whenever anyone went outside, it was like dead silent. Like they took the camera crew outside and there was no noise, like no crickets, no birds, like nothing. It was just because the cat had killed every single living thing in the county. And it's like, yeah, I mean, it's like, it's the same with people, you know, it's like, I don't know, you know, that's like,
but on one hand, I mean,
the cat world.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, it seems funny because why would it kill so many things? You know, I mean, on the one hand, it's a cat. What do you expect it to do? Actually, if I was a cat, I'd probably be going around, you know, killing birds. But what's strange is that it wasn't eating them and then being like, okay, I'm done.
No, it kept dragging them back to show the owners, like cats do. And they would just wake up and there'd be piles of corpses behind their house.
Did they ever cook any of it?
They didn't. Maybe they did, but they didn't say it in the show.
You know, you think maybe it just kept on bringing, it's like, what is the thing that they want? They never seem satisfied. Like my masters never seem satisfied with any of this stuff I'm doing. I'm going to keep on killing till I kill that right thing that will just satisfy them. Maybe if they just like taken the first bird, plucked its feathers, eaten it, shared it with the cat and gone, good work.
He just needed a little approval.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he didn't get it and an overachiever was created.
Exactly. You know, you never know, but I mean, it's like, I don't think like actual animal psychology is that much different from human psychology on fundamental drives.
Right. Yeah. One thing that John Balance said was in an interview at some point was that, you know, the definition of a pagan is somebody who sees human beings as animals. And I think that's basic sanity, you know, to understand that human beings are a biological organism, but most people are not there.
No, it'd be an interesting interview thing to do sometime and just go, like, stop people on the street and just be, are people animals?
Yeah, like a Jimmy Kimmel thing.
No, it would be true, because I know a lot of people who get, I've met a lot of people who get offended.
Right.
When I say, well, we're just animals.
What do they say instead?
It's like, no, we're people. And it's like, yeah, peoples are just like, it's like, we're a subset of animal. You know, the sharks, they're kind of animal. We're humans, kind of animal.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, we're special. We're special. We're different than all of them. It's like, yeah, is that a good different? Or is it just a different? You know, I mean, how do you judge?
We're animals having a crazy head trip.
yeah,
we can't get out of, where we think all this stuff in our minds is real and we're tearing up the environment because of it.
All this stuff. I mean, it's like, really, the whole concept of better and worse, I have trouble with in general. It's like, there's like and don't like.
Okay. But better or worse in terms of like hierarchy between
anything.
Okay.
Pretty much anything. It's like, this is, you know, like, no way. You know, people get very obsessed in like their worldview being, it's like the right virus that Burroughs made fun of.
The language being a virus?
Oh, no, just the right. He's talked about this right virus where it's like people need to be right.
Okay.
People really want everyone to agree with them.
Yes.
You know, it's like, no, this is better than that. Like, the burger at such and such a place is better than the burger here. It's like, well, I like the burger here, and you can like the burger there, and that's fine.
Why do you think people do that? Is it like a way of reality testing to see if they're, like, if somebody validates their likes, then they're actually valid?
You know, on a quick analysis, I just go, it's fundamental insecurity. That it's not okay. If nobody agrees with you, it's like, that's okay. Nobody has to ever agree with me on anything. If they can just leave me alone.
That's hard to remember sometimes.
If they can just, allow me to think whatever craziness I think, that's fine.
Right.
You know, I'm not saying, you know, I don't think anybody's like, have your crazy worldview. Great. The more color there is around, the better. You know, and they're all, again, like this evolutionary thing. It's just like, more diversity. It's all right. Good. The more, the better.
Well, this is something I bump into a lot, or bump up against with myself, where, you know, it's like I put so much time and effort into the idea of spreading magic and doing what we were just saying before, which is getting the material out there so that as many people are, in theory, liberated as possible. But I definitely get to a point where it's kind of like, well, okay, but is that just my ego? Is that kind of like my innate kind of, the fact that I was born in a Christian culture, so I have like a messianic kind of imprint from my culture.
Maybe you do. Maybe that's okay.
Right.
Some people need to be messiahs.
Everyone is, you know.
You know, and other people really need to be followers, and other people really need to be left alone and are very hermetic and
right.
You know.
But even like the idea of like, it's kind of like, I get to a point where it's like, well, what's the point of spreading magic? You know, it's kind of like, I guess it fulfills a function, because definitely a lot of people there are hungry for it and they want to hear about it. And
it makes you feel good.
Yeah.
It's a way that you can feel like you are contributing and making this world a better place.
Right.
You know, I mean, true or not, whether you're just promoting, you know, crazy Satanism or something like that.
Which I worry about sometimes, but...
Right, but I mean, whatever. I think it's like, you know, if it makes you feel good, don't be stressing it too badly. Because it's probably from a good place.
Yeah.
For the most part.
It is from a good place.
Even when people do, like, you know, sort of like BDSM practices.
Right. Usually, those can be fun too, though. Yeah.
Right, but I mean, no. But for the most part, and people in the community would say, it's like, nobody's being mean to each other. People are doing what they want.
Right.
Like, the person who's getting hit wants to be hit. The person who's hitting hopefully wants to be hitting. There we go. We just matched up two things that fit nicely together. It's only when it's actually rare times when it's this from this place of repression that people do truly cruel things. They want to see pain in somebody else. Not like a joyful pain, I mean actual suffering pain.
Right.
And that's a horrible thing.
Yeah, I always feel like, I have this feeling like ISIS keeps really trying to, like, ISIS is really trying to get into like a BDSM relationship with the West, and they're getting really disappointed that we're not fully going for it. But that's a whole psychosexual conundrum to pick through.
No, it is. And I mean, connected with the whole, I mean, a friend of mine is sort of writing a treatise about the three Abrahamic cult religions. Christianity, like, basically being sort of like, one is the head and one is like the heart and one is a soul thing. And, you know, this, or one is the body. And it's like Islam being very radical Islam, because I mean, all of them, you were looking at the most extremes of all of them.
Yes.
You know, that Judaism is this very intellectual religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these people, I mean, you look at the analysis that they've done at the Bible and the words and the letters right. and all of this stuff. I mean, all the...
It's unbelievable.
Gematria and all this sort of thing that yeah. they've gone into about analyzing these texts that they were given are supposed to be magical texts.
Mm-hmm. Which forms the basis for the whole magical thing.
Right. And the Christians, which are very much into this sort of like rapturous post-body experience.
Yes.
And Islam, which is like, no, this is blood and swords. And it's very embodied.
Yeah. Or, well, I think Islam at its core, the idea of submission is the idea of submission. You know, submission to...
Was the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. And the Father is this sort of like judgmental
right.
character.
Yes, yes, yeah. That's a whole can of worms.
Yeah. I have to say, I'm so glad to have been brought up agnostic, bordering atheist
right.
by my parents.
I was not. I was brought up pretty, in theory Christian, but not in a particularly severe or dogmatic way. So I definitely have a lot of Christian underpinnings, you know.
But I mean, they're just these, you know, they were these rules and ideas that were going to help people get along together. They get taken to extremes.
Just like anything. And I mean, not people can take anything. People can take magic to an extreme.
That's yeah, it.
Definitely.
And why does anybody else need to believe these same things as you? Can't they just believe whatever they believe and you can believe what you believe and that's all good?
Right.
I mean, if everybody drew the same painting, that would be a really boring world. If everybody wore exactly the same clothes, that would be a really boring world. If everybody ate the same things, it would be a really boring world. So let's not all believe the same things.
That's a very naturalist perspective, just like biodiversity.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's really... I think first year bio at University of Toronto, where I was, it was supposed to be molecular biology, but because in grade 13, just the time that I hit it, we all had such a hard background in molecular biology that they actually decided at U of T not to bother teaching us that in first year. Wow. And instead, it was all evolutionary biology. And that was really eye-opening. It was just like, wow, yeah, I've seen that because I've done a lot of camping and I've spent a lot of time in nature. And it's like, it is like that. Nobody's competing. Raccoons don't compete with another animal for things. They have a niche. Everybody's got their little niche. And you just make new niches and find new niches because who wants to be fighting with something else?
Right.
It's mostly only once humans come into the scene and destroy an ecology and now we have to fight just to survive. But traditionally in nature, nature just wants a whole bunch of little things that fit in their little tiny pockets in their little tiny place and it all works out nicely because nobody's needs what somebody else has.
Unless there's a cat that kills everything. You just gotta watch out for that one cat.
Right, watch out for that cat.
Yeah.
But cool.
So I guess that's the... I'm not sure how we should sum all this up, but the idea of, I guess, self-acceptance, liberation, engagement in the universe.
Yeah, explore, experience, and I don't know. I don't know what to say. It's been a crazy life so far. I'm hoping to double it.
Yes.
I'm only halfway.
Many happy returns. And I'm enjoying mine because continuing to get more and more surreal, like kaleidoscopic, like impossible
to define trip. Well, I just can't wait for the AI thing.
Oh my God. That's a whole nother...
No, but that's my whole like...
Are you positive about that or do you think it will be Skynet?
Well, regardless, I'm positive in that I think it's going to be really interesting when AI starts to really permeate. And it's going to take like 15 or 20 years, I think, from now. You know, they say even last 5 years. In 10 years, most lawyers will be gone.
Really?
Yes.
That's
definitely lower grade lawyers.
What a service to humanity AI is doing.
No, because was at a futures conference, they were saying this, because... A computer can read and scan, court will basically be able to read and scan the entire history of all case logs. and have it in its brain, every single word of it,
right,
and understand it,
right,
and therefore a case happens and it will just be like, boop, quote this.
what if it
and when you have
but who's gonna double check it though? That's the thing. Another AI, who's gonna check the work?
It doesn't, you don't need to worry about it.
Really? What if it's missed? What if like one letter was out of place in what was typed in 1878?
So this is AI though. It will recognize when you misspell a word and tell you, it knows what word you meant.
But is like understanding, but that's the thing. They're going to have to, with natural language processing and stuff like that, they're going to have to program context awareness, not just for current language, but for like all dialects and languages and
you only have to worry about English here.
Well, okay, I guess so. And legal.
Right, like legal stuff is written in the language of the country, and each country has its own laws. I mean, a French lawyer and an American lawyer, you can't work on the same things. They've got different laws. They've got different case histories.
But isn't part of the whole game of lawyering bending the rules, you know, and bending interpretations? Is an AI going to be able to get somebody off by saying, well, you know, this one ruling and the 1917 ruling on this could be interpreted in this way, and do you really want to look at it that way? You know, there's so many soft skills that go into that.
I think it'd be really interesting. I think it's going to be a very, very interesting time, you know?
I'd like to see a human lawyer debate an AI. That would be good.
How could the...
get Johnny Cochran versus an AI?
Johnny Cochran?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, I know who he is and everything like that. And not to diss on Johnny Cochran. I don't know him personally. And I assume he's a pretty decent lawyer.
But, you know, I'm just trying to think of, like, who's a superstar lawyer you can put an AI on the Supreme Court, see who they...
Whoever the best... Who's the best lawyer? But, I mean... Okay, you know, we're stepping up games lately. You know, chess, let's face it, humans suck.
It's done. Yeah, it's over. Forget it.
Jeopardy, humans suck.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we don't suck. I mean, it's like, we're not the pinnacle. We cannot do it. Deep Blue plays Jeopardy better than you do, which is weird. And I think nobody expected that. Everybody thought, oh no, how's it supposed to identify when these weird puns and stuff like that, categories that come up? It's smarter than you think.
Right.
You know, Deep Blue is now doing cancer research. Somebody was saying that it's just analyzing bazillions of photographs of cancers and actually developed from its looking at these photographs treatments that had never been thought of by humans.
Did they try them?
Before. They're now trying them. Wow. But I mean, it's like they're very hopeful because as soon as the scientists look at it, it's like, oh, yeah. God, we never noticed that before. Because it's like a connection that, because humans are really good at looking at that little spot in the front of their vision. But our peripheral vision is not so great. And to a computer, it's all the same. Like everything it reads is equal. It doesn't pay attention to something because it appealed to it in some aesthetic way or some other way. Its flatness in its approach is sort of pure objectivity.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think we're already beginning to see the start of that, what's going to happen.
It's annoying on dating sites, just let me tell you.
Oh, really?
Yes. I swear 1/3 of all the people that hit me up, maybe more, are not people.
Are AIs.
I'm suspicious. Either that or they're definitely people from other countries. But I'm starting to be suspicious about the AI stuff.
Okay.
Sentence construction is just wrong. Just a little bit weird.
Somebody's data gathering operation?
Yes. Yes, exactly that. And they're improving until you won't know whether who you're talking to is a person or a robot.
Wow.
And that's okay.
Well, I know there's for instance, sentiment guiding software, you know, that can create tons of fake social media accounts to manipulate the public discussion on an issue, right? So when you're online, even when you're in the comment section on a blog or on Reddit, it's like you don't know if those are actual people or not. You know, if there's 20 people all vouching for Monsanto, it's like that could just be, you know, software.
Right. And we're already at that point. And these people are not the top of the food chain, so they do not have the best software.
Well, the NSA is going to have quantum? They're working on quantum computers.
NSA, DARPA, are you kidding? These people have it going, and right. we don't even know.
Right.
You know, not to be too conspiracy theorist.
Well, no, it's just, I mean, it's just
the truth. It's obvious. Yeah.
I read something at some point that military technology is always 20 or 30 years ahead of the civilian, what's available to civilians.
20 or 30 years ahead of now? What?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. we yeah. can't even imagine what that is.
Yeah. Yeah. Cybernetic butcher cats that will depopulate entire forests.
To what end? To what end? The only thing I'm hopeful for is, like, to what end? What would be the upside of that?
Well, I think at the end, I mean, I'm not really a conspiratorial about anything anymore, just because the older I get and the more I read and the more I experience the world and the more I meet people, the more I understand, A, how nobody has anything figured out, and B, how everyone is trying to do their best from their angle of the world. So it's really easy for me to get into the mindset of somebody in the NSA or in, you know, the upper echelons of the military and think, you know, what would we have to do to protect all of these citizens who have no real understanding of the world situation or no real skills, certainly no ability to handle conflict or handle the complexities of geopolitics.
Yeah, and they're like, making votes, and when they don't even know what the reality is that they're voting about.
Hmm.
So we're just trying to do our best to protect you people.
Right, right.
And
right.
that is, yeah, I think for the most part, that is where people are coming from.
Right. So it's really hard to be, in fact, I'm not really conspiratorial at all. It's just kind of like, but then when you get into something like AI, that actually can start to be a little scary just because, yeah, I mean, when we talk about like mechanized warfare or they're talking about these land roving drones or aerial, you know, cyber, like AI drones, things like that. It's kind of like, well, at what point, and this is obviously the old science fiction cliche, but at what point is control lost? You know, the idea of traditional warfare is even kind of comforting compared to that, just because, well, at least, you know, there's a human being on the other end of the weapon, and human beings are incredibly cruel and can act in extreme ways when they're under stress or afraid. But there's a human being there. It's not like just a machine that's programmed to.
Yeah, but you don't just have it kill randomly. Like, you know, what's the saddest thing about all this warfare to me is collateral damage.
Right.
Right. And if you just go, okay, so you're an assassin robot. You go around. If somebody points a gun at you, you kill them. As long as people are walking around with no guns in their hands.
Yeah, but
let's
then
just
what
say,
if it sees a kid throwing a rock? As happens in these situations.
As happens. And then you'd be like, you blare out. It's like, do not attack me. I will kill you. Leave me alone. You are fine.
Did you see the new RoboCop movie, by the way?
I started watching it. It's sort of like, I don't know, maybe
it's
just
a super,
like,
cheesy movie, but it's actually a pretty, underneath all the cheese, it's actually a pretty good comment on mechanized warfare.
Maybe I'll try it again.
Yeah, it's the director.
I'm just so attached to the original.
Yeah, of course. I love the original RoboCop, but they politically updated it. It's the exact same movie with the exact same story, and as an action movie, it's not as good as the first one, but they updated the political satire for our current moment. I think it was well done.
I'll give it another look then. Yeah.
Well, maybe we should wrap up. We'll
wrap up on RoboCops.
Yes. And on that note, on RoboCop and mechanized warfare. And with that, my audio recorder very synchronistically ran out of storage space, but with perfect timing as we were just finishing the conversation. So thanks for listening. And if you've enjoyed the show, please grab my free 10-day course in chaos magic at ultraculture.org. And definitely subscribe to us on iTunes if you haven't already, and leave us a great review if you like. Okay, see you next time.